To such men as young Scipio, the sly, ineffective artfulness of Fabianism, which was causing both Italy and Carthage to bleed slowly to death, was detestable. He clamoured for an attack upon Carthage itself. But Fabius, on this occasion, filled the city with alarms, as if the Commonwealth was going to be brought into the most extreme danger by a rash and indiscreet young man. In short, he scrupled not to do or say anything he thought likely to dissuade his countrymen from embracing the proposal. With the Senate he carried his point, but the people believed that his opposition to Scipio proceeded either from envy of his success or from a secret fear that if this young hero should perform some signal exploit, put an end to the war, or even remove it out of Italy, his own slow proceedings through the course of so many years might be imputed to indolence or timidity. He applied to Crassus, the colleague of Scipio, and endeavoured to persuade him not to yield that province to Scipio, but, if he thought it proper to conduct the war in that manner, to go himself against Carthage. Nay, he even hindered the raising of money for that expedition, so that Scipio was obliged to find the supplies as he could. He endeavoured to prevent the young men who offered to go as volunteers from giving in their names, and loudly declared, both in the Senate and Forum, that Scipio didn't only himself avoid Hannibal, but intended to carry away with him the remaining strength of Italy, persuading the young men to abandon their parents, their wives, and native city, while an unsubdued and potent enemy was still at their doors. With these assertions, he so terrified the people that they allowed Scipio to take with him only the legions that were in Sicily, and 300 of those men who had served him with so much fidelity in Spain. After Scipio was gone over into Africa, an account was soon brought to Rome of his glorious and wonderful achievements. This account was followed by rich spoils which confirmed it. A Numidian king was taken prisoner, two camps were burned and destroyed, and in them a vast number of men, arms, and horses, and the Carthaginians sent orders to Hannibal to quit his fruitless hopes in Italy and return home to defend his own country. Whilst every tongue was applauding these exploits of Scipio, Fabius proposed that his successor should be appointed, without any shadow of reason for it except what this well-known maxim implies, that's to say, that it is dangerous to trust affairs of such importance to the fortune of one man, because it's not likely that he will be always successful. Nay, even when Hannibal embarked his army and quitted Italy, Fabius ceased not to disturb the general joy and to damp the spirits of Rome, for he took the liberty to affirm that the Commonwealth was now come to her last and worst trial, that she had the most reason to dread the efforts of Hannibal when he should arrive in Africa and attack her sons under the walls of Carthage, that Scipio would have to do with an army yet warm with the blood of so many Roman generals, dictators, and consuls. The city was alarmed with these declamations, and though the war was removed into Africa, the danger seemed to approach nearer Rome than ever. Before the Battle of Zama, there were a brief truce and negotiations which broke down through the fault of the Carthaginians. As with the Battle of Arbela, so the exact day of the Battle of Zama can be fixed by an eclipse, which in this case occurred during the fighting. The Romans had been joined by the Numidians, the hinterland people of Carthage, under their king, Massinissa, and this gave them, for the first time in any battle against Hannibal, a great superiority of cavalry. Hannibal's cavalry wings were driven off, while at the same time the sounder discipline of Scipio's infantry enabled them to open lanes for the charge of the Carthaginian war elephants without being thrown into confusion. Hannibal attempted to extend his infantry line to envelop the Roman infantry mass, but while at Cannae all the advantage of training and therefore of manoeuvring power had been on his side, and he'd been able to surround and massacre a crowd of infantry. He now found against him an infantry line better than his own. His own line broke as it extended. The Roman legion charged home, and the day was lost. The Roman cavalry came back from the pursuit of Hannibal's horse to turn what was already a defeat into a disastrous rout. Carthage submitted without any further struggle. The terms were severe, but they left it possible for her to hope for an honourable future. She had to abandon Spain to Rome, to give up all her war fleet except 10 vessels, to pay 10,000 talents, that's £2,400,000, and what was the most difficult condition of all, to agree not to wage war without the permission of Rome. Finally, a condition was added that Hannibal, as the great enemy of Rome, should be surrendered. But he saved his countrymen from this humiliation by flying to Asia. These were exorbitant conditions with which Rome should have been content, but there are nations so cowardly that they dare not merely conquer their enemies, they must maxicar and destroy them. The generation of Romans that saw greatness and virtue in a man like Cato the censor necessarily made their country a mean ally and a cowardly victor. 7th. The history of Rome for the 56 years that elapsed between the Battle of Zama and the last act of the tragedy, the Third Punic War, tells of a hard, ungracious expansion of power abroad and of a slow destruction by the usury and greed of the rich of the free agricultural population at home. The spirit of the nation had become harsh and base. There was no further extension of citizenship, no more generous attempts at the assimilation of congenial foreign populations. Spain was administered badly and settled slowly and with great difficulty. Complicated interventions led to the reduction of Illyria and Macedonia to the position of tribute-paying provinces. Rome, it was evident, was going to tax the foreigner now and release her home population from taxation. After 168 BC, the old land tax was no longer levied in Italy, and the only revenue derived from Italy was from the state domains and through a tax on imports from overseas. The revenues from the province of Asia defrayed the expenses of the Roman state. At home, men of the Cato type were acquiring farms by loans and foreclosure, often the farms of men impoverished by war service. They were driving the free citizens off their land and running their farms with the pitilessly driven slave labor that was made cheap and abundant. Such men regarded alien populations abroad merely as unimported slaves. Sicily was handed over to the greedy enterprise of tax farmers. Corn could be grown there by rich men using slaves and imported very profitably into Rome, and so the homeland could be turned over to cattle and sheep feeding. Consequently, a drift of the uprooted Italian population to the towns, and particularly to Rome, began. Of the first conflicts of the spreading power of Rome with the Seleucids, and how she formed an alliance with Egypt, we can tell little here, nor of the tortuous fluctuations of the Greek cities under the shadow of her advance until they fell into actual subjugation. A map must suffice to show the extension of her empire at this time. The general grim baseness of the age wasn't without its protesting voices. We've already told how the wasting disease of the Second Punic War, a disease of the state which was producing avaricious rich men, exactly as diseases of the body will sometimes produce great pustules, was ended by the vigor of Scipio Africanus. When it had seemed doubtful whether the Senate would let him go as the Roman general, he had threatened an appeal to the people. Thereafter he was a marked man for the senatorial gang, who was steadily changing Italy from a land of free cultivators to a land of slave-worked cattle ranches. They attempted to ruin him before ever he reached Africa. They gave him forces insufficient, as they hoped, for victory, and after the war they barred him strictly from office. Interest and his natural malice alike prompted Cato to attack him. Scipio Africanus the Elder seems to have been of a generous and impatient temperament, and indisposed to exploit the popular discontent with current tendencies and his own very great popularity to his own advantage. He went as subordinate to his brother Lucius Scipio when the latter commanded the first Roman army to pass into Asia. At Magnesia in Lydia, a great composite army under Antiochus III, the Seleucid monarch, suffered the fate in 190 BC of the very similar Persian armies of 140 years before. This victory drew down upon Lucius Scipio the hostility of the Senate, and he was accused of misappropriating monies received from Antiochus. This filled Africanus with honest rage. As Lucius stood up in the Senate with his accounts in his hands, ready for the badgering of his accusers, Africanus snatched the documents from him, tore them up, and flung the fragments down. His brother, he said, had paid into the treasury 200,000 sestertia,